Hello. Thanks, everyone, for coming today to Cybersecurity Defenses, What Works Today. My colleague Mark and I and our esteemed colleague Laura Robinson, who couldn't be here today, are part of teams at Microsoft that work a lot with external customers. And a lot of those customers call us, and the call begins with, oh, my God, we're completely owned. They have all of our passwords. They're all throughout our environment. We have malware and secret back doors and, you know, can you come help us? Or sometimes that call is, we got rid of them once or twice, and they're back again, and we just can't get rid of them. So we've been called out to a lot of these types of attacks where these environments are completely owned. And over the last couple of years, we've been able to take a look at what works and what doesn't work. So that's what this talk is about today. Is that probably one of the most common questions we get asked is, how do I get rid of them? How do I keep them out? Whatever them is. But what works? And we have a lot of people that we come in contact with that think that it's some type of something you buy, or it may be a part of something you buy, but they think if I just buy more firewalls or more IDSs, or I just make my passwords longer or something like that, that they're going to get rid of the problem. And what we're here today is to say, from our experience over many, many years dealing with the same thing, here are the things that did and didn't work.
So, hi, my name is Mark Simos. I'm with our MCS, or Microsoft Consulting Services, cybersecurity team. And that's kind of a listing of the backgrounds of the folks that are on it. So what they did was, you know, they put our team together and, you know, brought together all the backgrounds that were needed to address this holistically. And so, you know, in the solutions that I've built and interactions with Roger and Lori and their team, we put together approaches and knowledge sets that help us understand what the actual problem is and what the solution approaches are. And so that's the team that I come from and where the experience is that I'll be sharing today.
And I come from a different team that's actually part of Microsoft IT, so the inside IT of Microsoft. And our team does internal consulting and external consulting. And the great thing is that internally, you know, Microsoft's one of the largest organizations and most attacked organizations in the world, with a worldwide footprint and, you know, hundreds of thousands of employees and all kinds of devices, Windows and otherwise. And we get to help look at what inputting security controls, responding to events internally, plus the great benefit is working a lot of the newer products. But we get to take all those internal lessons learned from managing a large environment with those products and take them to our external clients. And probably even better is what I like is I'm part of a team that takes a look at the things that worked outside external clients and I take them inside to Microsoft. So it's very much a win-win for everybody involved. I mean, the nice thing about having access to internal Microsoft stuff is we can actually talk to the guys that wrote the code, which is kind of nice. But the nice thing about talking to y'all is finding out most of the ideas that we're presenting today are things that we got from other customers, or at least we worked with other customers to see what did and didn't work on a broader scale.
So I have a question. How many people here would say their primary job is security? Okay, how many would say their primary job is IT administration or some other IT pro, IT management role? Okay, and how many folks would say that they're managers or directors rather than technical folks? Okay, thank you. So, to give you guys some perspective on what we see out there, the way we view the bad guy spectrum is very much a spectrum. There's a lot of variety in terms of what these guys are after. So while many people like to cite certain countries or certain areas and have a particular bad guy in mind, in our experience, there's a whole lot of them. And they're after different things and they have different motivations. The important thing to remember is whenever you connect an internet connection, whether it's a wireless on your laptop or a physical Ethernet tap on any device, you are connecting to a network that has direct IP connectivity and routing to little internet cafes and island resorts in Thailand, all the way through any number of countries and any number of organizations with different goals. So when you connect up to the internet, you are connecting to just about everybody else in the world and every other device, potentially. So you have the ability to talk to them, they have the ability to talk to you. So it's very important to understand that what's out there varies extensively depending on what the motivation of the bad guy is. So, the ones that worry us the most, and one of the things that we want to get across today, is we see a lot of organizations out there in terms of who the, quote, bad guy is. This is the one that scares us a little bit more, because this isn't just an automated virus and then you learn how that virus works and you shut it down. This is an actual organization with a specific mission to accomplish something or steal some piece of data or disrupt some business process. They have a specific goal. So this is the thing that scares us, because it's a much longer term persistent threat. So what we typically see in their behavior, and again, this is based on our observations of what we see. We don't have guys that are over there in their cubicle farms interviewing these organizations. We just, you know, this is based on the behavior that we see, obviously. But if you're targeted, they will profile who has admin rights, who are the people that actually click on phishing emails, who are the ones that are likely to do it. We've seen targeting of the same person over a 6 or 7 year period. They remembered that that person clicked and they specifically targeted that user. So they have a long memory. And that's not in every case, but in this case it was. And they also know who has access to the data they want, who's working on a particular secret or important project or something that hasn't been released. They build that profile up through public sources, your Facebooks and Twitters and all that kind of fun stuff, in addition to what they obtain during the actual attacks. So the tactics that we see primarily is they want to get control of your identity store, because that is a treasure trove of information to them. There's a public side to that, so think Active Directory users, groups, group memberships, and email affiliations, all that stuff that's stored in AD that any user can read is very valuable to them from an intelligence standpoint. And of course, if they can get onto your DCs and dump the entire DIT file and pull that and take that back, they also get access to the secret side and start cracking those passwords at their leisure. We typically see in the initial stages of an attack, and keep in mind that sometimes we go onto a site and they've been owned for 1, 2, 3 years, 7, 8, or more years. So they've had this presence on their network that they haven't that customers haven't known about for a number of years. So the initial time, we typically see a very large truckload of data leave the network. But after a period of time, or if these guys already know what they want before they attack the network, more and more we're seeing targeting specific data. They want the executive emails. They want to know what these guys are thinking, where they're looking at investing, the pricing of particular goods, the negotiating points for an upcoming negotiation or conference. They want to know these things as or before they're supposed to. And of course, a very, very popular tactic is they want to sprinkle custom malware throughout the whole environment. And they put it on a couple of random hosts because, quite frankly, getting into a network, while it isn't impossible, it's harder than staying there. So if they can just deploy some malware to a couple random hosts, it helps them stay there and makes life easier for when they want the next piece of information. So these are the five areas that we worry about most. This is where we see the scariest activity. One is that targeting, which I've covered. Another is phishing. We see a lot of phishing emails. There's many ways to get into a network, one of which is a particularly creative one that we saw in a hack a few years ago was they took ownership of the company's web server, which, how many of your organizations, your default web browser homepage is your local web server, your own company homepage? Well, if they want to get in, put a zero day or an exploit on there, and next thing you know, you got all sorts of corporate PCs and plenty to choose from. So we see a lot of creative stuff like that when needed, but most of the time it's just a phishing email to a couple of people that are likely to click or a couple addresses that may.
Yeah, and sometimes they have very specific project information. Like it isn't, the normal can't recognize this email, but a lot of times they are very specific about a project that this person is on, about a pending merger, that the people literally look at this and go, it looks so legitimate. that I had a hard time not clicking on it. So it isn't just the simple ones that hit, or you know, the people that hit the dumb people. It's ones that are very targeted phishing, very specific information. Most of the time, information learned somewhere else in the network that was then used to phish that person.
And it can also be learned from public sources such as Facebook. So you have to be very concerned about information disclosure in those spaces, because someone could learn a writing style, what project someone's on, and put a plausible email together, usually fairly easily with that. Pass the hash. I'll do a live demo of that and show you guys what that looks like and why that's very scary, because that magnifies the impact of losing just one corporate box. Custom malware. We're in an era where antivirus and anti-malware is very good and very useful, but the bad guys have a copy of it. They have a copy of the same signatures that you do. They can test against it, and we're seeing a lot of custom malware literally compiled for a particular customer for a particular attack. And we've even seen the name of the company as the password to access it, presumably because they attack so many companies they can't keep track of which malware is for which particular company. Application exploits. The big one we worry about here, especially for them getting in the first place, is SQL injection. That's a huge, huge way for a particular kind of attacks. Often you're anonymous, and the flash publicity type of attackers like to use SQL injection to get in because it gets them the web server. It's a good way to get to those troves of PII data that people enter in over the web because it's always connected. So we're seeing a lot there, but that isn't all of it. There's also the applications that reside on a desktop are also a big threat vector that we worry about.
Yeah. And actually, before you head on here, we were talking amongst ourselves, and actually all three colleagues, about how prevalent these are. And these are the reason why they're here is these are all very prevalent in most attacks. But we agreed that past the hash, which is why we'll cover it more, that we'd seen that in every single attack. You know, that was a very common thread to break into an environment, to become a part of the domain admins and dump the DC's hashes, that happened in every single case except for one?
Yeah, our two teams collectively have only seen one on our team that didn't use pass the hash. We're fully convinced that they could have if they wanted to, but they weren't after that. They had actually specifically targeted the user they wanted that had the data they wanted, so they didn't need to go and grab any other identities or steal anything else. So in that one case, we didn't see them actually use it. But in every other incident, we've seen pass the hash used. And you'll see why in just a few minutes. So actually, it'll be just a few seconds. Sometimes I forget the order of the slides. So pass the hash starts in a number of ways. Ultimately, the starting point of the pass the hash part of the attack is that one domain member has been compromised, one trusted node in the Active Directory domain. So in this case, and as is very often, there's a phishing email that gets sent out, and they only need one user to click on it, or one exploit to succeed. Either way, they get ownership. They are able to install system-level malware. Not user-level malware. It has to be at the system level, which you need to be a local admin or a local escalation of privilege to get to. But if they get their malware running as system, they can collect whatever credentials are logged into that box at the time. They can also collect whatever's in the local SAM file. So they can grab the hashes, the NT hashes, also known as NTLM hashes, from the local SAM, grab the local admin account, any other local accounts that are there, grab those, as well as any user that's running a process there. So if the user's logged on, if there's a service account running, if there's multiple users logged on, they can get all of the credentials for all of those users. And then they proceed to use those credentials to do what we call the credential crab walk, and compromise more systems until they get something that takes them closer to their goal. In this case, a domain admin was logging on to one of those workstations. That's that gold credential. Once they have that domain admin credential, it is pretty much game over. Because while they'll only compromise the ones that they need to and install malware where they need to, ultimately the whole domain belongs to them, because they are equivalent to that domain admin. They can log on as him using his stolen credentials anywhere they want, and they can do whatever he can, including backdooring into business processes, into database servers, creating new accounts that have those so that he doesn't need the domain admin, because ultimately that's a shortcut. They really don't care about being a domain admin. They care about the data and the processes and their ultimate mission, and that's just a shortcut way to get there. Questions? So, would you guys like to see it happen in action? I heard one yes. So as long as I can operate the switch box, maybe.
Let it go slow. Hold on.
Wait
now,
for it.
Now. Can we hack the switch box? Yeah.
Can we operate the switch box? Okay. So what we've got here is a very, very basic domain. We've got a domain controller there. By the way, we are using our latest and greatest virtual PC technology. This is top-of-the-line stuff. So on the left, you'll see our domain controller, cleverly named DC. On the right, you'll see our client machine, cleverly named client, and the domain, domain. So just to keep everything straight. So what I'm going to do, so this client is essentially a simulated malware-infected PC. So we're going to do everything manually, but we're going to be doing it as a local admin account that doesn't even, it's not even a domain user. It's actually just a local account on that box. So I'm going to log in. Hopefully. Okay, so now I'm in as a simulated malware session. I'm a local admin. I'm going to move my laptop over so I can see that screen. It's very difficult to type and look that way. And the big caveat to this is it does have to run as a local administrator. This cannot be something that is running as just a standard user. So I'm going to do a quick who am I. You'll see I'm just local admin on that machine. And if I try to even net use to the net logon share, I'm not a very good hacker, by the way. You don't have to be to use this. We have nothing. We're being prompted for credentials because we've got nothing there. However, I'm going to go to my handy-dandy WCE toolkit, and this is not a Microsoft tool.
Cannot get it on Microsoft download.
Yeah, this is called Windows Credentials Editor, but this is not a Microsoft tool. This is a security researcher / hacker tool. The scariest thing for me was when I started demoing this about 6 months ago, and then shortly after that, we started to actually see this tool in hacks as opposed to custom hacker malware, which was quite a frightening experience, quite honestly. So if we just run WCE, pretty straightforward. There are our both the username, the source, you know, whether it's the domain or the local client, landman hash, and NT hash, also called NTLM hash. And so those are the credentials of the two accounts that are running things. I don't have anything particularly meaningful here because one is the account I'm already in, no gain, and the other is the machine account, which I can control. So nothing significant yet. However, I can run WCE-E, which does the same thing, and this simulates malware, where it hangs there and waits for a logon event. Next time a logon event happens, it re-scrapes LSA memory for any new credentials. So let's go ahead and switch over, and we're going to completely switch users and start a whole new session on this same box. And we're going to log in as our unsuspecting.
And this is actually a key point, that they have to log in interactively some way, so RDP or something like that. If you just map a drive there, you're not capturing the hashes in memory. So it has to be some type of interactive login.
And at this point, my domain is owned. I don't know it because I'm an unsuspecting domain admin, but at this point, my whole domain is now in control of the attackers. So I'm going to log out and go check and show you what that looks like from the hacker's point of view. And quite frankly, it does happen that fast. We've seen in the real world, this can take anywhere between 24 to 48 hours to find the domain admin credentials on a live, normal network. for these attackers because they are operators. They are typing stuff in as they go. It's not automated malware per se. But pen testers, we've actually, because we have better data on that, we've seen pen testers get it in 6 minutes flat. So logging back into our hacker session, essentially, you'll see that there is now a new credential there. And you could say, well, how hard is it to use this new credential? Well, everybody here know how to copy and paste? And now I am this domain admin. So let's go ahead and do that net use again. Let's just go to the $share on our DC. Okay, we're there. Oh, I'm a bad hacker, so I forgot the star. And we do see typos for these operators hacking, which is slightly amusing. And the next step is, of course, we want to copy our hacker tools to this DC so we can start dumping the DIT and having fun. And as you can see right there, it's already game over.
So an important part of this, too, is, of course, you had some malware waiting that wasn't detected and all that sort of stuff. And that's a big question is, how much undetected malware do you have in your environment? The unknown unknown, right? Well, I actually wanted to find that out in a company, so I couldn't tell all of it that was unknown, but I asked a simple question at this particular very large company, which is, how much software did you discover, malware did you discover the next day, 24 hours later, that had been placed there the previous 24 hours? So 24 hours went by before it was detected, but it had been there at least a day. And in this large organization, it was like 15, somewhere around 15. That was a pretty small number. But if you think about it, that means every day, whether it's the same 15 terminals or another, there's always at some point some small percentage of computers with undetectable malware within the environment. And if the domain admin logs into that PC, it can be compromised. And that's the big thing, is that every time you log into a computer with elevated credentials, you're testing that computer, or you're trusting that computer with a transitive trust that they're not hacked by malware. And odds are, within your environment, there are some machines that are hacked by malware at any given time in your environment, whatever that percentage is.
Yeah, and all this ultimately goes back to the basics of host security. Are your hosts secure? And who is local admin? Because that's the easiest way into this, is if your users are browsing the internet as a local administrator and they can convince a privileged account to log on or perform an operation, maybe they can convince a help desk to come in and add a program or change something. If they can do that, then they can get any creds that are exposed to that box. So it is ultimately back to host security. And the same privileges that allow you to do this, which is local administrator, also enable all sorts of other things like keyloggers, screen scrapers, you know, anything you want to do on the operating system, a local admin can do. And just to sort of illustrate, everyone ever heard of reversible encryption? Well, reversible encryption is called that because, quite frankly, it can be reversed. And there is a copy of a user password stored in memory that is reversible. And so,
say that again? You can disable reversible encryption.
And there's two places where the passwords are stored. One is in the SAM database and or Active Directory ntds.dit file, and there are group policy settings for that. However, this is in LSA memory. Because you typed in the password for this session, you have access to things as plain text using digest authentication and a number of others. And so this is essentially LSA storing your plain text password on your behalf.
If you can get system access, we cannot stop you from getting the plain text password equivalent. No GPO there will stop this particular thing from happening.
Correct, because this is getting it from the live process in LSA as you're logged on with that session, because it's authenticating on your behalf. From a functional perspective, a NT hash within a domain is functionally equivalent to a plain text password. They are equally as powerful within a domain environment. Plain text happens to be more useful if you're going to try and use that same password to hack Facebook, to hack a Twitter account, to hack some other corporate account, if they're the same password. But within a domain, an NT hash is as valuable as a plain text password.
Although, actually, the plain text gives you one thing that you don't get with a hash. We can replay it throughout the organization, which is great. With the plain text password, I can go remotely, right? Do OWA or any type of remote login, and chances are you're not going to detect me nearly as readily logging in with the correct username and password. So I can be both local and remote if I have the plain text equivalent.
Yep.
So slightly different.
And just for demonstration purposes, let me skip that part. There is a tool, and I guess I've ripped out the DLL for some reason. There is a tool called pwdump, and there's a number of other equivalent ones that will grab that SAM. And that same format that you saw with the WCE is copy-paste compatible with the local SAM password. So if you do have local admin accounts that have the same password on every single machine in your workstation environment, then you lose one. With the right tools, you lose them all. So keep that in mind as well. Any further questions on that, or back to the slides?
Yeah, so the question is, are some of these tools not detected by antivirus, whether it's Forefront or other things? You know, certainly if you go to some of the large sites out on the internet, like VirusTotal or something like that, I don't think I've ever seen malware submitted that was detected by every engine right away. But you mean WinCE? Yeah, so that is now detected by most of them. Certainly it's detected by ours.
Yes, the freely downloadable tools that are easily available to anyone generally are detected by almost all the engines. I know ours is really good at picking them up, which makes my demos a little bit harder. But the key thing to remember is that what is known by these guys can be put in a custom tool like that, and it doesn't match any signatures. And they have the ability to compile complex and intricate malware for each given attack. So you can't really rely on antivirus to stop the technique per se.
Yeah, and a lot of times, and this is a demonstration of what they might do, but most of the time they're using some type of malware, custom or otherwise, that's doing a buffer overflow and then capturing access that way. So it's in and out very quickly with something that isn't detectable.
Okay. I forget. We're there. We're good.
Thanks. So what I'm going to talk about next is just a part of the protection. So we're going to talk about these next three topics here. I'm going to cover in a little bit more detail over the next couple of slides. Know what matters to protect, effective workstation and server defenses, which is what y'all are really interested in, and how to protect your key identities and roles, which is probably even more important. But lastly, and we're not going to cover this in today's session, but it's always good to employ the security development lifecycle in any custom development code. Microsoft's been a big proponent of security development lifecycle for a long, long time, since the Trustworthy Computing Memo that went out many, many years ago. And security development lifecycle has factually significantly minimized the number of bugs that we have in our code. You can go to any database that tracks vulnerabilities, and our software not only has significantly less bugs than it used to, but it has significantly less bugs as compared to our nearest competitors. And that's across every product line and every product class that you can compare against. We have significantly less vulnerabilities into the software. But we go to a lot of clients' places, and their software, they don't follow SDL. And the way that the bad guy is getting in, whether it's SQL injection or cross-site scripting or whatever, is that their code isn't employing SDL. And the best thing is Microsoft. If you go to Microsoft.com/SDL, we share everything that we know. That we tell you what we do, how we do it within Microsoft. We give, there's all kinds of free tools, and there's thousands of pages of downloads of pages and things. I guarantee you we have more about SDL than any other company in the world, all available for free. And as well, we have classes and commercial stuff and commercial tools as well to help with that. But SDL is a big, big deal, and it really will help you be more secure.
Yeah, for web applications facing the web, as well as custom applications that, you know, line of business applications that you or your customers are running, that's the answer. That's how you deal with that. When you own the code, that's the best way to deal with that problem. There's only so much you can do with the infrastructure configuration if the app is not secure.
Yeah, which I guess that even begs the question. So we're not perfect. We still have lots of vulnerabilities, right, that come out every month usually. But we've become so efficient at minimizing the number of bugs in our software, the number one way people get exploited today is how? socially engineered Trojan coming to the desktop, that they don't rely upon any software vulnerability. They just simply trick the end user into running a Trojan or some type of malformed PDF file or something like that. So we're not perfect, but it is well enough that the bad guys have already said we don't want to attack the operating system as much. They don't attack that nearly as much as they used to, not even the browser. The most common way is to trick them into running a fake antivirus or some type of malformed document. Number one way people get exploited. So the first thing is to protect the crown jewels. If you try to protect everything the same way, you will fail. So I go into a lot of companies where we're like, oh, we're going to do two-factor everywhere, or we're going to do smart cards everywhere. And we're like, how long is that going to take to do everywhere? They're like, 18 months. Well, that's great, except for that's a long time for your attackers to be in your environment. So the first thing we try to say is that first you have to identify what do you want to protect? What should you protect? And that's a big question. I'd say most organizations that we've gone to, when we've said, okay, what do you want to protect? The first question is, what do you have? What's an inventory of every application and service that you have? Most companies don't have that. As simple as that seems, they don't have that. Not only that, but they don't know who owns it. They don't know what it takes to make it work. They're not sure if they disable this service account, what it will do. There's so many things running in most organizations that people are scared. They're like, if I touch that, if I disable that service account that's been around for 20 years, I may break something. And they know that they're more likely to get in trouble for causing an operational problem than they are just to let status quo go for a little bit longer. So one of the first things we say is get everybody together and try to identify what are all your assets and what are the crown jewels. What is this stuff? Like at Microsoft, we came, said part of our crown jewels is our source code. And actually only particular parts of the source code, not everything.
Yeah, and keep in mind that every organization is going to have different crown jewels. There's going to be a different nature to it. But if you don't know what applications, if they go away tomorrow or if the database is compromised tomorrow, we don't have a business tomorrow. I mean, that's what you have to know. You know, kind of as a responsible IT person, we need to know this so we can protect it at the right level. Of course, the solutions for each of those is going to vary. There's going to be commonalities, but the solutions will vary. But you have to know what is most important to the business and take care of that.
Yeah, so we'll go into places and say, oh, we're going to protect all of our web servers a certain way. And they really have no idea how many web servers they have. But our thing is, we don't want to protect every web server. Some public-facing web server with documents that are readily available is not nearly as important as something that has your trademark copyrighted information or something that maybe has secret intellectual property information. So not even all web servers should be protected the same way. A great quote from Dean Rusk, U.S. Secretary of State, is if you protect your paper clips and diamonds with equal vigor, you'll soon have more paper clips and fewer diamonds. And that's absolutely true. Another thing to understand, too, is what does the attacker want to get after? You want to say, what is our crown jewels? What does our company think is our competitive crown jewels? What is the thing we need to protect? And then what does the attacker want to get after? Right? There are different things. You value different things than the attacker values. And you got to figure out in the threat model what your attackers are. And also what you protect, what you defend, which is never, ever 100% the same, and then what the attacker wants. And look at the overlap there. There's not a whole lot. There's a whole lot more other big space. So that's important with the crown jewels, not only saying what's important to us, but then what are we going to protect that the attacker is likely to go after?
Yeah, and the more you can keep that in line, the better off you'll be because you'll be protecting what matters and investing there as opposed to the wasted efforts on the margins and the unexpected losses.
And another big strategy that we tell people is to make these concentric rings of security. So you identify your crown jewels, and then for those things, you protect them heavily. You put them on your most heavily protected servers. Maybe you require two-factor or smart card authentication to get there. Maybe you have IPsec or network access protection running in that ring. And you really spend your initial resources trying to best protect your most valuable resources. And once you've got that under control, then move out in another ring, and then move out in another ring. So we've had data classification structures and schemes forever, right, led by the military. The idea is to make networks that are secured around that. And not all data should be protected equally.
And this is something that you want to start with, and it will mature over time. Because over time, guess what? We've released that product. It's been in the wild for a while, speaking from a software company. So at this point, the source code isn't as big of a deal as the new version of it, so we can move certain parts of it down. And then there's other things that we discover. You know what? This is critical to our business. We're creating new information. Where does it land? So this becomes a dynamic system. But you definitely want to set it up in a good way to start with and get started on it, but understand that things will move over time. They will become reclassified, and they will go up and down in terms of priority.
And if you saw Brett Arsenault's talk on consumerization of IT, the idea was we have different user classes, different device classes that allow you to do different types of security, and those things also fit into here. So how far are we going to allow them into the environment? Like we have thousands of iPads and iPhones in our environment, but we're probably not going to allow them to get to our newest source code. I'm an administrator within my realm of sphere, but I can only get to a certain amount of servers, and I can't get to the source code. I have no valid reason to get to the source code. We have a completely separate network for our source code. There's different smart cards and different certificates and, you know, air gap stuff to get to the source code, to the most protected part of the source code. Mm-hmm. Rings of security.
Yep.
If you try to do it all, you'll fail. So, effective defenses, protecting your host. Movement, we're going to talk about all of these in the next coming slides. Other than probably patching, compliance, and configuration management. Probably compliance and configuration management, not as much, but the other stuff we're going to talk about a lot.
And the other one, if we can go back for a second, the other one that we don't have a slide on is that top bullet, moving users out of local admin groups. I know the Microsoft security guys have been beating on this drum for a very, very long time. There's a very, very good reason for it, and you guys saw that in action today. Because, quite frankly, you don't have a security boundary between pass the hash starting and one application exploit, application level exploit, not OS level, application level exploit, if the user is a local admin. If you want to put a security boundary between one bad click and one application exploit and losing everything, you have to run your users as standard users. So just keep that in mind.
Another big one, this makes common sense. Keep current, stay current. One of the responsibilities of one of the teams I have at Microsoft is when one of our other customers gets a really big hack. I mean, one that you hear in the mail, that's in the media, and they've lost tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars. I sometimes get involved to try to duplicate that attack, saying, how did it occur? What were the methods that were used? What can we do to help that customer? And in almost every case that I've been in, although I'm sure it's not every case we've experienced in Microsoft, that the exploits that made these companies lose tens of millions to hundreds of millions of dollars required that they have software that wasn't patched for years and years and years. One of the two biggest exploits I looked at last year required that they not to have applied a single patch to Internet Explorer and Word for at least 5 years. And, you know, in any environment, that's going to be bad, right? So certainly you have to keep everything patched. But not only when you patch stuff, you get two benefits by keeping up to date. First of all, you get that they close all the old holes, right? All the known vulnerabilities get closed. But the other thing is they all have improved security features, whether it's, sandboxing, sandboxing Internet Explorer 9 or Adobe Acrobat Reader or Office. Like now Office, right? What a pain when you open up a document. Office is like, do you want to you're in read-only mode. Do you want to do the edit there? And you're like, what a pain. Well, let me tell you what a pain it is. It stops every vulnerability or exploit that I've seen for the last, for the last 10, 15 years. It works. So you get two major benefits. But the other thing is the most common ways that you get exploited is by Internet-related content, right? Whether it's Adobe Acrobat, Java's a big one. Internet Explorer is actually number 3 on the list. But the top 2 are some other add-in helpers. And I go to places and I always go, are you fully patched? They're like, yes, yes, yes. What they really mean to be telling me is that they're fully patched in Windows, that Windows Update and WSUS is doing its job. But in every single case, in every single company I've ever been in, when I did patch checking, they had old versions of Java. They had old versions of Adobe Acrobat. They had old versions, get this, old versions of the software most likely to be exploited. And that's every company I've ever done an audit on. Even if they tell me no, they're like, no, we're perfectly patched. And the first machine I check doesn't have it. They're like, I'm perfectly patched, but that's a web server, and the web server is controlled by another team. So they start giving me excuses why everything's not patched. I'm like, and this is the most common stuff that's exploited.
And keep in mind, from the attacker point of view, 0 days are like diamonds. They're rare, they're valuable, and the more you use them, the less valuable they become. Okay, so diamonds isn't the perfect analogy. But if they can get an old exploit for something that should have been patched 10 years ago, that's dirt cheap, it's freely available, it's not a lot of effort for them. But if they have to start risking their highly valuable 0 days and their recently patched stuff that may not be fully patched to everybody because it just came out with the last month's MSRC bulletin, you know, you're pushing them into their expensive and more effort, and they may not be able to hack as many customers at any given time. So the better you are at this, the better of a chance that you're going to be able to just get rid of the whole a whole class of more casual attackers or more opportunistic ones. So everything you do with this security, you're driving the bad guys' cost up, especially in this area. Because if they have to hunt real hard to find something that you're vulnerable to because you're fully patched on all these apps, you're in a very strong position against a lot of players. Not all of them, but a lot of them, because there is that massive spectrum out there.
So better patching, and not just operating system patches, but certainly your internet browser add-ins, that sort of stuff. But here's a big one, firmware. We've now started to have increased attacks against firmware. There was a big one in China. We've had ones in the past. But I can tell you for sure that the governments of the world, certainly including the U.S. government, the U.S. military, they feel strongly that there is a significant chance of increased attacks against firmware. And, of course, Windows 8 is coming out with secure booting that takes care of a lot of that, but not everybody's going to be on Windows 8 on day one. But also, how about HP? Anybody here have an HP printer? You know, HP announced a couple of months ago, said it was like the printer list they gave me was like HP 4, 4 Plus. It was like every HP printer I've ever used and had in my environment. It's susceptible to firmware overwriting using printer control language that can be accomplished over the internet. We recommend that you immediately update the firmware on all these printers. No company I've been into has ever updated their printer firmware that I know about. And it's that times the router firmware, the wireless controller firmware. I've done a lot of research over the last year in this field. The only thing I can tell you, I don't know whether how pervasive firmware attacks are going to be, but I can only tell you that it is probably, from a malware writer perspective, orders of magnitude easier to brick your machines and your routers and your printers than it is to do a regular email worm. It is very easy to brick something. By brick it, I mean that it's not going to operate again until you get new firmware on the board or rewritten. These days, firmware is usually soldered to the motherboard, and you have to have the right equipment to rewrite it. But you're not doing it very easily. So keep that in mind.
And there was an article that some of you may have seen about 4 or 5 days ago that described the side effect of malware for a printer, where, you know, 800 pages of random machine code was printing out of a bunch of printers because the attackers had put malware on those printers. And the organization didn't know until it started spitting out unprintable characters because there was a bug in the malware.
Yeah.
So this is actually being exploited. So it's not just the
erratic. Although that wasn't a firmware attack, but
yeah. Wasn't technically a firmware attack. Yeah.
I'm sorry, you said not a...
Patching is a reactive approach.
Yeah, so patching is reactive, but I got to be honest with you, because we don't patch, the attackers don't have to... I mean, we're not doing the reactive things we need to be doing. So attackers are taking the easy stuff. Yeah. I agree, yeah. But
yes.
A lot of times, most of the time, attackers aren't doing 0 days. Most of the time, they're doing stuff that has been unpatched for years.
Yeah, it's part of due diligence. If you don't do it, they will exploit it. If you do it, you force them to use more advanced techniques.
So, big thing here again is not just OS patches, and also start to put that on your radar about firmware. Not being attacked a whole lot, but there's a lot. If you go to NIST, NIST.gov, there's a lot of papers on it, and there's a lot of people that believe this is coming sooner than later, and it's a lot easier to accomplish than any other malware thing that I've ever seen.
So... Actually, this is perfect timing because this, how many of you heard of Emmett? Oh, okay, pretty good number. So Emmett is a tool that does allow you to get a little bit more into the proactive space. This is a tool that, quite frankly, we love. It's all those great technologies that you've heard about, like DEP and ASLR, that are included in Windows, some of which I think it's like the /GS or GX switch and, Visual Studio. A lot of those technologies are great, but they weren't widely deployed. They weren't something an IT admin could use to protect their network. Along comes Emmett and changes that and makes things a lot easier for you guys to take advantage of all that research that Microsoft has put into exploit mitigation.
Free download.
Free download. Free tool. And it has System Center and group policy stuff that comes with it to help you get started. And so Emmet is a phenomenal tool that allows you to opt in any application on the box, user mode only, but you can opt in any application on the box to any of these 7 mitigations. So there's some stuff in the operating system that we couldn't, you know, for example, ASLR, we couldn't push that through to every single application because it would break way too many of them. But an IT admin that can test their apps before they put it out can push that out there. And then, you know, as long as your apps don't crash with it, you should be good to go in production. Normal application compatibility rules apply. But this will now protect all of those applications that you opt in from those techniques.
There are common internet plugins that people rely upon that don't have these protections today that could, with this tool, have those protections and not be vulnerable to some of the exploits that are put against them.
Other couple nice things. You opt in IE, you get all the plugins for free. You opt in Office, you get all the plugins for free, you know, depending on the binary, your Word and Excel. But you get the plugins with it because it actually goes to the binary that the user executes. And what we recommend, and this is very much reflected in the defaults that come with, but the pre-configured files for GPOs and for SCCM, it actually comes with Emmet 3.0, is opting in the apps that commonly process internet or untrusted content, because that's where your risk vector is. When these apps, such as your browser, your plugins, or your Adobe Reader and your Office, when they take in internet content or unknown content, that's where your risk of exploit comes in, or a big vector of it. And so we love Emmet. It's a phenomenal tool.
I was actually a disbeliever when it first came out, the first couple of versions. I was like, you know, whatever. I've since had many customers tell me that this helped them and that they could demonstrably say that it reduced successful exploits in their environment so that we have success cases.
And the from a realistic standpoint, it protects you in 2 scenarios. Because if you're patched, you're patched. But if you're not patched yet and it's been out, or if it's a true 0 day, this does have protections in both of those time frames for a given exploit type.
All right, here's a big one. A lot of our advice, so far you're like, I've heard all this stuff before. Maybe Emmet was, you know, new or something. But a lot of the stuff is common sense advice. And here's another one. Good, better end-user education. Very common sense. But every single company I go to that I visit, I go, let me see your end-user education. It seems like it was written 10 years ago. They're telling people to be careful about file attachments and macros. I'm lucky they're not talking about boot viruses or something like that. But I always ask, does your end-user education tell your end-users that they're most likely to be exploited by a website they trust the most, that they go to every day, that they have been going to every day for, you know, 5 or 10 years? Most malware comes from legitimately exploited websites, and sometimes they're through banner ads or whatever. But we're always telling people, be careful, you know, you don't want to go to untrusted places, or maybe you don't want to, you know, don't go to porn sites. Well, as far as I can tell from looking at the actual data, a pay-per-view porn site might be one of the safest websites on the internet.
Just for clarity, we are not recommending going to porn sites. I know we're in Amsterdam, but we are not recommending that.
No, but what I want to say is most, if when I look at people's documents, they always go, oh, be careful about untrusted sites. I mean, what has that ever meant in the first place? But number two, again, is most people are being exploited from the sites that they trust. Or another big one, it says, does your current end user know does your end users know what your antivirus looks like? If one of the number one ways that people get exploited is the fake antivirus screen, do you and your end user education teach them what theirs should look like? I mean, does your end user know the difference between the real one and the fake one that's coming up? I mean, I think it's wild that end user education almost never covers that, and then we are amazed that they fall for the fake antivirus. But what I'm even more amazed about is I give this, and when I do an analysis of a company, I go, this is something you need to improve. I come back a year later, and it's still not in the end user education. So this is simple stuff, but if your company's not doing it, it's a very simple, cheap way of decreasing risk in your environment. And also, I'm a big fan of the PhishMe type, you know, contest. There's an open source one, I forget. There's a paid one, PhishMe.com. There's a bunch of them out there where you can put in your email addresses, send the list, and they will send a crafted phishing email to your employees asking for their credentials, and then you get a list of who responded and gave their password, login names and passwords to fake people on the internet. And then you can kind of slip them into a special education class or send them a 5-page PDF or invite them on an early Saturday morning to attend special education. Asset isolation. So it used to be in the old days, make sure you have a firewall. Well, it's actually a little bit harder than that, than perimeter-based firewalls. But what you need to do is ask yourself, what assets should be talking to other assets? Like, does every workstation in your company need to have the ability to talk to every other workstation in your company? We're talking about how the bad guy breaks in, breaks into one machine, starts going horizontally, breaking into other workstations until he gets another elevated credential. Should that workstation be allowed to go to that workstation? In most cases, no. How about server? Does every server in your environment need to be speaking to every other server in your environment? Do they need to be talking to every other workstation in your environment? Most of the time, not. You only have a few servers that are supposed to be talking to everybody, but a lot of times they're like SQL Server should be talking to the front-end web server, and we have some admin people that need to be talking to the SQL Server, and it's a handful. Most organizations I go into, with even hundreds of thousands of PCs, are all one big open network, or they have perimeter network that stops the outside from the inside. What I say is look at network flow and network traffic analysis. Ask yourself what should be allowed. And then whether you use network access protection or IPsec or firewalls, I don't care how you do it, but start looking at what should be able to talk to each other, because if we can stop them from talking to each other, we use a lot of IPsec inside of Microsoft, and if a bad guy breaks in here, he doesn't immediately get access to all these other places. I was in one of our foreign country Microsoft offices when they got one of the USB viruses, Conficker, that went off and hit a lot of people, and it infected every machine in that office, but only, even though they had admin rights, only infected 8 other machines within inside of our internal environment, because they literally could not get to those other machines. So it's a good thing to do. Isolate, isolate, isolate.
So there's a term that a number of CIOs were basically exposed to at a recent Gartner conference called creative destruction. And what this is a way of essentially decommissioning legacy applications and systems, because a lot of the reasons why you have to keep your security settings low and have all sorts of strange contortions and management difficulties in an IT environment come from the legacy applications that were written 5, 10, or more years ago. Would you agree? Okay. So Gartner's position on this is to go ahead and catalog what you've got, much like Roger was mentioning earlier, figure out what your application portfolio is, and also figure out what the functionality of those applications are, because you may have 3, 4, 5, 10 applications doing the same thing that are owned by different silos or different organizations within the larger company. Then identify the redundancies, what are the duplicates, and then create new specs on what this should look like long term. And then while they were heavily advocating the cloud, there's a couple ways of doing it. You can either find a cloud provider that can provide this right away, or you can write an application, whether it be cloud-based or on-premise based, to meet the needs that have that same set of functionality that your catalog needs, and then use that to pipe that application data out, retire and kill the old applications, and then get rid of them, and then you're away from those headaches. So ultimately, this is about replacing old applications with new, good, more secure, well-written, friendly, metro-based apps type of applications. And the nice thing is that they are getting, that the upper management is getting this message from Gartner, and so this is something there. If you want to go ahead and get rid of applications for security reasons, this is a way to tie into agendas and objectives that they're getting from independent outside counsel or consultancies. So just as a sort of tip on if you need to start addressing those types of issues.
Again, very rarely are 0 days used to break in. I mean, that does happen. Mm-hmm. But almost all the time, and certainly most of the cases I've been involved in, it's these holes that have been there for years. Or the company is running, they know that I need to be in the latest Java, but they're still running 10 versions, right? And they still have like 5 installed in every workstation, including ones with known vulnerabilities. And by the way, the client side or the website can call which version of Java it wants to run. And when you say, why can't you get rid of it? Well, I have this application, they're always old. They rely upon it. So why don't you take an inventory about what's needed? Is that Java piece, that version of Java you think still needs to be around, is it really still needed? Or did they stop using that application because it got supplemented by something else years ago? Well, you don't know unless you go through the process.
Yep. So getting to the third part of the talk, the protecting your key identities through Active Directory and other means, there's three main pieces that we recommend here. One is practicing something we call credential hygiene. Multi-factor authentication we really like. And reducing broad and deep privileges. So this is applying least privilege to the privileged accounts.
And if you're falling asleep, start paying attention here because this has huge value.
Yeah, this is
huge bang for the buck.
This is the stuff that you can start taking away and doing things with. So credential hygiene is composed of basically two principles. One is that privileged accounts should only log on to sufficiently secured hosts. That means if you have a domain admin account and he's logging on to a workstation, do you trust that workstation he's logging on to do his work with the security of the entire domain? If you don't and it's not secured that way and you let someone browse the internet and do whatever they want on it and check their Facebook and click on whatever malware may be there, and you also use that domain admin credential on it, that's a massive risk because you are entrusting that security of the whole domain to just that one workstation because you're entrusting the creds to it.
I mean, hackers love the idea.
Oh, hackers are very happy about that, yeah. Makes their lives easier. And ultimately, there's another piece of it that's woven throughout, which is separate your internet risk, because that's where 99% of our risk comes from today, is direct internet remote attacks, not people walking around the hallways. Although that is a risk, it is not the predominant one that we see. But separating that risk from the privileged credentials that can do a lot of damage. So of course, the reality is this can require doing a lot of design and redesign around privileges, doing least privilege, host security, logon rights, GPOs. There's a lot to it. But fundamentally, if you stick to that rule of thumb, and we've got some suggestions on basically how to go about this in a way where you get the best bang for the buck first. And the first thing is that rule of thumb is you want to protect wherever those admins log on, wherever those privileged accounts log on, at the same level as you would the servers and apps that they administer.
And just to stop again, this can't be said enough about how important this piece is. Some people are kind of grazing over this or going, okay, I know this. And we're going to go through many examples. Here on out, we're going to show you a couple of examples of how to solve this. But this works so much better than a new IDS or changing my passwords longer or going just to smart cards or something like that. I mean, this when people go, well, how do you keep the bad guy out, or how can I tell whether a company is going to keep the bad guy out? It's this right here. When I come in and I see this, I know the organization's got a chance. And all the other money that you can spend on this really doesn't even usually cost money. Maybe you might pay a product or two to help you with it. But you can do this without spending any money, and it is the best, most effective way for you to protect your environment. This is, if you're looking for a secret or something, this is it, and we're going to give you a couple other examples of it.
This is literally as basic as washing your hands before you eat. It's that simple. It's a matter
and
of credential
nothing
hygiene.
Else will work as well as this.
So one suggestion for compartmentalization, and you'll see the architecture in a bit, but this is one way that we do compartmentalization on a solution that I'm an architect for on my team. So there are certain things that have to be done from a secure maintenance perspective, and production domain admins, we recommend the two-factor piece, and those accounts should be partitioned out along with all the other resources through ACLs and such so that domain admins can log on to domain controllers and workstations that are at that same level, and all of the other pieces that can lead to either of those permissions, such as who's the local admin on those domain admin workstations, who has the ability to log on to install software on those machines, the ACLs on the domain admin's group, and the accounts that are in there. All of those things fall into that one tier and should be protected in the same way, at the same level, with the same level of scrutiny. Of course, we always recommend that you identify those crown jewels. What are the most important things? Because that's the next most important thing. We know what the IT crown jewels are in terms of the domain admin level permissions, because you can do a lot of damage with it. And then per company or per organization, what is the stuff that if this was lost is a devastating problem? And let's go ahead and secure those as our next priority. And then work our way through kind of our standard server admin roles. And the more compartmentalization we can do, the better. But fundamentally, if you get those colors down, you're in a very good place. And then the more compartments you can get by role, by the actual functionality of the application, the better off you are.
And you don't want a single account that can go through multiple boundaries. The idea is that one account lives in one boundary and doesn't go through the others.
And that way there is no exposure at a lower level from a higher level. So basically divide the problem into big blocks, and then as you're able to in the next phase, divide it into smaller blocks and make it even harder for the bad guys while still making sure your users can do what they need to do and your admins can do their job. A big, big piece that I advocate for is if it's easy for the admins to do their job and they don't have to fight the system to get their job done, they're not going to want to dismantle it. We want this to be something that the IT admins and every other admin and every other user likes and enjoys. It doesn't interrupt their work, if at all possible. You want the right thing and the secure thing to do to be the easy thing to do. So two-factor, or multi-factor. We're big fans of multi-factor authentications, just defined up there so you have an idea of what the factors are, what you know, which is basically something you can type in a keyboard, which is completely electronically repeatable and transmittable. Username, password is one-factor authentication. When you bring in a smart card or some other device, such as a text to a phone, and there's a number of different approaches to it. Smart cards are good. RSA tokens had an article recently. And then, of course, the third category is biometrics. Biometrics have certain types of limitations. So if someone grabs the fingerprint database from your company because you've got all 10 fingerprints in there, they've now got every fingerprint of every person. You can't reset your fingerprint like you can a password or a PIN or reissue a new smart card. So there's limitations around what you can do with that. But the more factors you can introduce, the better. The two pieces, the most important thing that you want to achieve with a multi-factor authentication, because there are just going to smart card isn't going to magically do it. But if they can't use an identity over the internet because it actually requires the physical presence, then you have raised the bar significantly on most attacker teams, significantly. And of course, smart cards are natively supported by Windows. Win8 has a virtual smart cards. There's a lot of good stuff in there. And so.
The only thing to remember, a lot of times when you're using smart cards and things like that, they'll still have an NT hash behind the scenes of that user account. And if the bad guy can dump that hash, they can actually still act as if they're that person. So just because you have a smart card or some other two-factor that protects them from doing interactive logins, if they can get that hash still is the keys to the kingdom. Even if that hash is not even used, well, inside of Active Directory, that hash is the keys to the kingdom. So just keep that in mind. You don't get perfect protection, but at least it requires a physical presence of that other factor somewhere else.
Yeah, so it's a lot of it is how you implement that two-factor to make sure that that hash isn't theftable, which would, of course, make it remotely attackable. You?
Yep. So this is another thing where we're saying, okay, what you want to try to do is eliminate all accounts that have both broad and deep privilege, enterprise admin, domain admin. You want to minimize or eliminate as much as you can these huge accounts. The bad guy gets in, breaks in, takes over workstation, gets domain admin credential, game over, right? So what you want to do is make it so I went to a company recently in the last month that has not a single permanent member of any elevated group at all. There's no members in there at all. If they add them when they need it. And when they do, it's very time-based focused, passwords change, it's a one-time password that's generated. And that was one of the first companies I could say that I think they have a really good chance of not being infiltrated by a determined adversary, because the determined adversary almost always breaks in, goes to the domain controller, dumps the hashes. Well, if there's nobody in domain admins, they have to add themselves to domain admins to get that permission. or they can do some other things, but for the most part, they always add themselves to the group or take over a domain admin account and then dump the hashes. Well, there is no domain admin account. There is nobody that has that ability to do that automatically. So if the bad guy adds themselves into domain admin, they get an alert. And to test them, I added a person to the domain admin's account, and seven different pagers went off around me about 17 seconds later. And I said to them, I said, would y'all investigate that? And everybody said yes. They didn't even hesitate. I went, wow. So the idea is that you want to eliminate all types of accounts that have both broad and deep privileges. No permanent member in any super elevated group or any accounts with equivalent privilege. Because if they get that deep and broad privilege, they get what the attacker wants, which is your environment. So a couple different ways that you can do that. Sometimes IT staffs are given multiple accounts. Maybe they have a regular account and then an admin account and that sort of stuff. And then sometimes maybe they get that second account that's protected by multi-factor or something like that. A big thing that we also see, though, is that if they use an elevated account, that they have to go to particular jump servers or bastion hosts, that they can't just go from their workstation to the problem area, that they have to log into this jump server. And a lot of times it's just a virtual machine unique for them, and every time they log out it's re-cleaned and everything. But the idea is that that jump server, that bastion host where they're going to start doing all their admin stuff from, that's protected a lot better than somebody's workstation that's surfing the internet every day.
They trust it as much as they trust a domain controller, and that's the intent, is to provide that, whether it's a local workstation on the desk that's secured, or we use special credentials to get to a jump server, and then that one has creds. But ultimately, you have to trust where those creds live and are entered as much as the DCs.
Yeah. Okay. How many people here use some type of jump server in their environment? Okay, good. And keep your hand up real quick. And do you think it makes you more secure than without it? Wave your hand like this if you think so. Yeah. It's most of them. And it's once you get used to it and you implement it, it's not that hard. And the great thing is you can do that isolation we talked about to particular hosts. Instead of everybody talking to everybody and every server and every workstation talking to every workstation, we can now put it around the bastion host and the jump servers. A lot easier to control that than it is everybody else. Another thing we see out there is people will time bound and say, okay, you can be a domain admin, but you can only be a domain admin for today or 1 hour or 2 hours or something like that, temporary access. And the passwords changed when they come back out. That's a fantastic way to control it. So even if the bad guy gets your hash, that hash is only valid for a very limited amount of time. You know, by tomorrow or whatever, that hash is useless to them. Yeah, and then this is kind of role-based access control versus privileged identity management, two different ways that we see, and we see this a lot. So role-based access control, I'm a big believer in, that you create help desk roles, and you create workstation troubleshooters and server troubleshooters, and you make all kinds of different role-based accounts. Nobody, like when I give you domain admin, when you have to be domain admin for a reason or enterprise admin, it's because you need to do something specific. But the reality is you don't need to do everything that a domain or enterprise admin encompasses. So create these role accounts. If you have to administrate a certain amount of file servers, make it an account that gives you full control over just those file servers or just those users or just all those objects that's in the OU. But you don't want to have one person they've compromised takes over everything. So this is a big thing where they do role-based access control. They create different roles and groups that are named after roles. So it isn't you don't give every help desk person, you know, domain admin or something like that. It's just complete control over various objects or to various permissions. And a lot of people use delegation, the Active Directory delegation wizard. So they'll right-click, say delegate this OU and allow them to do this, change passwords, add user accounts, add computer accounts or whatever. And I've seen multiple companies that do this, and probably the big push away people go, that's too complicated, it would break too much stuff. I'm just here to tell you that it does not, and that the IT people in those organizations don't hate life. They like life. You know why? Because they're compromised less. They get blamed for breaking less stuff because they don't have the ability to go break something else. They like that.
And the nice thing, the role-based piece handles the day-to-day tasks. So this is what I do every day, every week, very frequently. Every once in a while, I'm called upon to rebuild a domain controller, do something that requires a high privilege, but it's not something I want to carry around every day. And that's where the PIM comes in and says, you know what, for this period of time, you can go do a break fix, and it locks down afterwards, because you don't need to be adding sites and subnets and whatever the tasks are every single day. You're not promoting up domain controllers and taking domains up and down. I mean, those are rare special events, should be approved. And that's kind of where those two come in, is one's your day-to-day, and one's your special occasion, break, fix, emergency. Yeah.
The only thing we say is we kind of avoid the products that have this special proxy account that does everything on behalf of the user, because once the bad guy takes over that special proxy account, it's game over. What we'd rather see them do is be a product that inserts you in the correct groups or delegates the right permissions on the fly and then pulls you in or pulls you out as needed versus that all-encompassing, all-enterprise admin account that you're trying to get away from in the first place. And again, so this is like Mark covered for day-to-day. Role-based access control is a fantastic way to go. And it also allows you to understand how you service your environment, who services your environment, and what are the responsibilities. And then going back over to the other side for break-fix, maybe that's more for privilege management, which is broad versus, and again, that's another thing too. If you have to go broad, don't go deep. And if you have to go deep, don't go broad. And for those things that have to be broad and deep, minimize them. I can tell you that the places that have no one in there or one or two or three accounts are significantly more secure than ones that have dozens to hundreds to thousands. And I've seen it run the gambit.
And so
here's an example of that we've seen some people where they disable all the accounts, the main admin accounts, and on top of that, the disabled account, though even Mark smart card is required for interactive login, even if it's not, just because it creates a really long hash that's difficult to crack. Let's say the account is sensitive and cannot be delegated. And then, so you can do all these things to these accounts. And the big thing is you're looking for auditing, to be able to say, hey, somebody added me to a domain administrator. Let's flag on that. Or somebody enabled this account that we know is supposed to be disabled. Let's audit and alert on it.
And to put this in context, this is once you've done RBAC and PIM or something where you've gotten the admins out of there. This is how you take those accounts like the administrator that you can't delete. This is how you put them out of reach. So the first part was telling you how do you get to that point, and then once you get there, this is how you take the admins out of the risk factor and start alerting on activity that is very unexpected. So another example of a way you could do this, which blends well with the RBAC and PIM methods, this is actually the architecture of the MCS solution that I've been working on. We do that credential partitioning piece. It's a combination of group policies as well as selective authentication restrictions so that those admins simply cannot go above and they cannot log on below their trust level. They can always, of course, log on over the network to get their domain controllers, to get policies from their domain controllers. But fundamentally, they can't reach down and do exposure. We introduce an administrative forest that's purpose-built and dedicated for that purpose, and that hosts hardened workstations that restrict those particular admins to only talk to the host that they need to using IPsec, host firewall, as well as network firewall rules that are in place. We provision the accounts that are high value in that dedicated admin workstation environment, your crown jewels types of server admins, as well as your domain admins, and then we also by protecting the production domains, we then put the workstation admins into there. So we take advantage of the fact that we have this purpose-built forest, and we do some things like monitoring for anything being added to groups that are not expected, modifications to certain groups and users that are not expected, and auto-patching, because we consider inconveniencing a few admins of having a reboot unexpected here or there is not nearly as bad as having an unpatched box.
And just yet another example. So we talked about different ways. This is yet another example that can work and has worked for some entities. But the common theme in all of this is that you have boundaries, security boundaries, not just in your machines, but in your authentication credentials that go to those particular boundaries.
Yeah, and the core of this, there's a lot of things that we built around it, but ultimately, the separation, those red dotted lines, is the core of this solution. All these other measures are to ensure the integrity of that. And of course, we do service account hardening type of stuff as well. So the big takeaways, figure out what's important and protect that first, foremost, and with the most vigor. That's where you want to spend your energy and resources first, is what's most important. And we provided you some host defenses that we think are extremely effective in today's environment against the threats that we see. And protecting those important credentials, by priority, of course, but protect your credentials and your hosts that matter first and most.
If you want to take the years of experience that not only we've had, but we're talking about with the organizations we've dealt with for years, of all of their teams going through the process of what did work, this is it. A lot of people will look at this, go back, you can't work my environment. I'm here to tell you that everything else that you can try is not going to work as well as this does, because we've been there. I've been with many organizations that said, oh, we can't do that. After a year or two, they come back to something that's somewhat like this, because that's what does work.
Yeah, this is what will actually survive the pain.
A better antivirus is not going to save you, but delegated responsibilities will.
Yeah. And my team obviously does solutions, and so if you're interested, come talk to me. And
the same thing, we have the internal teams, and we're just about out with a minute left, but if you have any questions, come to the side of the stage, and we'll be glad to ask you, unfortunately, be off mic. But thank you so much for putting up with us, and we will be glad to take any of your questions. We will stay around as long as it takes. So thank you very much, and have a good time at the conference.
Thank you.